This is Carl Thomas reporting for EG. I'm sitting here with Graham Barnes, an executive director on the Capital Advisors team at CBRE. Graham, you hosted an event. Can you talk us through what it was and what was discussed there?
Yeah, sure. And thank you for spending some time with us. We run a series of publications on a quarterly basis from our Capital Advisors business entitled Four Quadrants, which is a way of looking at real estate investment, capital flows to and from, and the attractions thereof on a four quadrants basis. Now, what does that mean? It's looking at the world of commercial real estate as an investment asset class, and then looking at four different principal ways that you can access those returns. Public and private equity, so the listed markets and the funds markets, and public and private debt. So that's public debt bonds, essentially, and private debt bilateral loans as investment mediums. Okay. And the event that we hold once every 6 months is a seminar, usually with an introductory speaker and a panel drawn from across the industry on a sort of Chatham House rules basis. So nothing is attributed, but the themes can be discussed, looking at what the issues are that people are facing. And obviously, because of our intense real estate focus, looking at what that means looking forward for the prospects for real estate investment strategies and hence capital flows, which all comes down to pricing in the end.
What are the main themes that we should be looking for?
Well, I guess, unsurprisingly, it all had a bit of a big political kickoff to start with. Now, whether that's global politics and Mr. Trump and French elections, all the rest of it, or more domestic, and we've got the Brexit issue, and then obviously now a general election in the UK. This provides a nicely sort of uncertain set of events and forthcoming events against which to set the scenario in which real estate activity takes place. And for all of that, and I mean, I think Miles Gibson, our head of UK research, has been very clear on our view on what the Brexit prospects are. But I think we have to take back, Brexit hasn't happened yet. And there's an awful lot of that still to come. And whereas we don't think that this is going to change the world in any respect, particularly from a real estate point of view, it's obviously something that people gives rise to uncertainty and therefore decision-making gets hard. Perhaps more broadly, there's this bit of a loss of faith in experts. You know, Michael Gove has a lot to answer for in terms of saying, we don't need experts anymore. But you look at the election of Mr. Trump, and you look at even Macron, who's never been elected to anything. This kind of, people turning not to experts, perhaps. And whereas, you've got populists proposing local solutions to global problems, in Europe, generally, the centre is holding. So, a lot of noise, maybe not a lot of change. And against that uncertain background, there's really quite a lot of, the underlying economies continue to move in reasonably positive directions, reasonably stable. The hangover of the GFC still continues, which means we're into a long, low cycle in which real estate continues to carry on doing its business. So that's so it's the economics leading the politics rather than the other way around. So for all that uncertainty, everyone quickly dived down to, okay, so what's going on? Certainly there were views expressed that we are probably towards the end of an economic cycle, but then people turn around and say, hey, hold on, what's that mean? And people are talking 2-3 years out, maybe things beginning to sort of reach the end of their natural life. But there's a big feeling that that's quite US-centric in some respects for some people, talking about rising rates, inflation pressures, more than the UK and Europe, which is lagging that environment. But also some people looking again with this GFC hangover hat on for as one person put it, a long, low, boring plateau, with continuing low but perhaps slowly rising rates, and an absence of the sort of economic excesses and growing imbalances that often presage downturns. So irrational exuberance seems in short supply, lots of spec development, rapidly rising rents, getting real estate specific, probably not. Excessive debt, hard to find, perhaps outside of the public sector. And exposure to rapidly rising or higher interest rates. Again, on the debt side, not so much. Yields, a bit of a different argument. But again, our view is that the exposure of yields to slowly rising rates is not all that great. We don't think it's that sensitive to it. So that provides quite a a stable background, at the risk of some people arguing, well, it's all different this time. And I don't think anybody is arguing that. I think what they're saying is cycles continue, but we're actually looking at something that is long and drawn out and relatively low volatility, rather than the, you know, to pinch a phrase from politics of the not that distant past, the sort of rapid boom and bust cycle.
Do you think that's going to continue after this cycle sees an end?
Cycles come and go, and they are different lengths. And Reinhardt and Rogoff wrote a very, very boring book that did point out that after a big financial crash, you often get a very long and drawn-out cycle, and we seem to be having a long and drawn-out cycle. Nothing's fundamentally changed, but it does look that shape. And people if you then talk about how people were thinking about investment strategies in real estate, people do seem to be adapting their investment mindset, and those capital flows, which are so critical to our industry, it makes the level of activity that we see, do seem to be reflecting that kind of mindset. And maybe we'll talk a bit more about, you know, what the risks of that are when we get to the okay, what can go wrong bit of the conversation, which will probably be where we wrap up. And I guess thinking about what people say, okay, in that environment, in the environment in which we are living right now, what does that mean that people are doing in terms of their investment strategies? And there were a variety of views, and there were people drawn from all sorts of parts of the industry, both on the panel and in the audience, who participated freely and enthusiastically in the discussion, which is one of its, you know, most endearing features, actually. It ends up being very conversational. I think someone turned around and said, look, the rearview mirror is a fairly poor guide to the future, and maybe the business experience of most of us, given the age, the range that we have, and therefore the cycles we've lived through, it might be a particularly poor guide to the future. Real estate was argued quite strongly from somebody outside of the real estate space to looking quite attractive. And you look at where you can deploy your money, cash, fixed income, credit, look relatively expensive compared to real estate. Real estate might have low nominal yields by historic measures, but still quite high real yields. And this is what's driving big asset allocations. You know, the flows of cash from the guy who says, I can do real estate, but I can do fixed income or infrastructure or something else as well, or instead. And I guess the only thing that was thought to look materially, less expensive was actually equity volatility. And I think a lot of this might be driven out of one better versed person than I liken this to people still wearing the scars of the last capital market cycle and the end of the big up run into the 2007-08-09 and the correction there, where that degree of price volatility is still quite a scary concept for a lot of people. So real estate's not looking badly positioned. So what are people doing in what appears to be a sort of longer cycle, a lower growth cycle? And said, look, the hyperactive developers, which I thought was a lovely ring of phrase, and I suspect it's being used quite a lot by certain people, are perhaps that type of strategy is less in vogue at the moment, and the values, the attractions of reliable, stable, long-term income flows from good quality, well-let commercial real estate, which again I think speaks to this thing about value compared to fixed income and government bonds, credit as a whole, are really sort of finding their day in the sun. And you're seeing this with people particularly around logistics and alternative sectors, student, PRS, that healthcare, that sort of thing. You've obviously got an awful lot of change going on in the way people work, the way people shop, the way people live, house themselves. And those changes are being reflected in strategies and pricing that people find attractive. They can see upside to, and those that they think are vulnerable and downside. Then you've got circumstance-specific risks, and those are also affected in people's mindset, where there's uncertainty about locations of business and job numbers and job number growth going forward. And you can see that. And if you look at REIT pricing, you'll then say, look, the very active developers are off a bit. The people who are heavily exposed to the retail sector, which is reshaping itself, are down a bit. And the people who have really performed well are logistics and alternative sectors. So there's a logic here that, you know, is not inconsistent wherever you look.
And in terms of geography, so where is the UK in terms of you know, attractiveness for overseas capital? Where are you seeing interest in the UK?
Okay, well, there's different. I mean, you can look at the UK and you've got Europe as a whole as a context. I mean, European investment volumes last year were very good. The UK's were a little weaker, but the first quarter of this year has been pretty spectacular, particularly London. So, you know, it's very easy to turn and say, oh, in a Brexit world, London's not going to look very good. And then you look at the investment volumes and go, hey, hold on, you know, there's a different story being told out there, and it's being told by the money. And, you know, they're backing their views with cash. I think there's an issue there that might also have, there's a big chunk in it of FX, currency. You know, you've definitely seen in the evolution of the political and the economic world that having your own currency gives you some big advantages. And adopting local solutions to global issues is really quite hard if you don't have control of your own monetary policy and your own currency. It gives the UK a huge advantage. You've also got sterling looking comparatively cheap compared to the range in which it has sat relative to other currencies for the last 30, 40 years. And it's actually swung between not, you know, getting towards parity with the dollar to about 2, and it swings between those 2 points, and at the moment it's at the lower end of that range. So someone buying an office building in central London with a 3 and change yield with a currency play attached is very different to someone buying the prospects for a office building with a 3 and change yield without a currency play on it, and that's clearly a part of that. And if you think that what that means going forward, you've not seen a big move. Yeah, sterling has strengthened compared to its lows, but compared to the long term, it's still a long way down. So, you know, maybe that's a big part of people's thinking. You've certainly had advocates within the room for investment around the UK in various sectors, and people can talk about, you know, if you look at the centre of our big cities around the country, they've not seen the development volumes that people cite as a risk in some other places, and you've certainly seen plentiful investment in logistics and actually in bringing forward new retail space and so on. I mean, you can point to whether it's Oxford or Rushden Lakes and so on, with new schemes going on there. And the expansion of the hotspots of logistics, you know, it isn't just the Golden Triangle anymore. So there's attractions to be found across the UK. On a European basis, European volumes were good last year, but if you look at the unlisted market, you know, the market for exposure to pan-European core is deep, and, you know, they are paying good prices on the secondary market for fund interests, and the queues of cash trying to get into the pan-European core funds run by, you know, there's two or three big ones and so on, and they've increased in size very rapidly, and they have, you know, substantial money to deploy. So that's a very popular strategy.
What about value-add or opportunistic?
Well, there's a lot of money being raised, and we were going through a price discovery period, particularly post the referendum, I think. There's plenty of people out to buy. Relatively little necessity for people to sell, perhaps at the point at which people will buy, but, you know, there are deals getting done. I think you've probably found where the price point is. The volumes perhaps aren't quite following it, but you need a little bit of stress or a little passage of time for that to come through. But there's certainly no shortage of people with the ambition to do it. Perhaps a bit of change in the strategies. You know, if you've got a low growing cycle and you've had the bounce off the bottom now some years ago, so it's hard to buy fundamentally cheap as a value-add strategy. So therefore you're going to go and do something. So you're increasingly seeing people doing some fairly substantial repositioning or even ground-up development to go after those kind of returns.
Was there anyone or any type of investor who didn't want to be in the UK or anymore, who thought it's just not a very, very attractive a proposition anymore?
I didn't hear a voice last night turn around and said, "Look, I, you know, I'm off. I'm on the train to wherever, or on the plane to somewhere else, because I can't see where I'm going to go in the UK right now." I think that you do find in a lower growth environment, and we do seem to be in a lower growth environment, again, with no immediate fears of the cycle ending tomorrow. Who knows? That's the future. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. Relative pricing for capital, you know, still makes real estate in the UK look attractive. That is very hard to argue. And there's some strong arguments that turn around and say, look, you look at yields, those prices, they're very, very high. But the real estate doesn't exist in a vacuum. You know, a private individual can decide to keep money in cash and lose progressively on a real basis because interest rates are so low. But pension funds and sovereign wealth funds and insurance companies and like do not have that as an option. And they are particularly sensitive to losing money in real terms, and particularly in more mature funds who have liability streams they have to service, paying pensions, need yield. And real estate and the UK real estate industry, particularly with our lease structures and so on, is still pretty attractive as a source of yield.
What are the downsides then?
Okay, it's interesting actually. It was actually more positive than I imagined it would be. It was surprisingly strong. And you also had people from the debt investment side into real estate. So these are sort of non-bank lenders to real estate saying, look, it's a great time for our asset class. You've got borrowers, with relatively modest levels of leverage seeking to extend maturities because, locking in low rates is good for them. And equally as investors in debt as an asset class, those kind of yields that are not a million miles away from where high quality real estate yields are, but with someone else taking the first slice of capital risk, because you've got the equity beneath you in the capital stack, certainly has its attractions. They seemed happy boys. You had the relative value guys arguing that real estate had its attractions compared to other asset classes, and you had the real estate specialists turning around saying, look, depending on what your strategy is, there are attractive ways to make money that are very income focused rather than necessarily perhaps development focused as a general theme. Always good examples and good opportunities to take forward, and rather than expecting prices and yields to fly around rapidly. So that was all relatively positive, especially in the context that people didn't seem to believe that the cycle was likely to turn over in the short term, because they quite frankly don't see the excesses and the imbalances that presage downturns in the past being sitting there in front of them. So we did have quite a lengthy conversation about, okay, so what are you worried about, and what is it that sort of concerns you? And I think that top of that list was, okay, where are we in the cycle and what turns that over? And there was a focus there focusing on inflation and the likely effect of that on rates, and the rising rate environment being something that will typically and traditionally slow a cycle and obviously may have a particular impact on real estate. Because whether or not it's true, people believe that it's true that rates and real estate are closely related. Quite a lot of evidence to the contrary, but we can debate that till the cows come home. Slightly US-centric view on that, I think. I'm thinking of the US as a leading indicator. But again, the US is not advanced in that cycle right now. Second idea was turning around and saying, look, if you're looking at a UK economy that is so heavily weighted towards consumer spending, so therefore the evolution of UK consumer spending and the impact that has on retailer margins, and that's demand for real estate from whether it's the retailers or whether it's the people who supply them through the logistics chain and so on, is obviously something that people investing in those kind of spaces are particularly focused on. There is the rising rate environment. We've been talking about rising rates for a long time, and there seems to be that phrase lower for longer that was sort of all the buzz phrase in the sort of 2011, 2012, and now seems to be so old hat. And maybe the risk is in that. It's a risk that we're capitulating on that, and everyone's now thinking, well, they're going to be lower for longer, which means they're never ever going to go up. Well, that means that people start aligning themselves and aligning their strategies and their risk management and everything to a world in which rates don't go up, in which case when they do, you may have problems. So that was a set of risks. And actually, probably the most interesting comment that I heard about risks was, look, at the moment, we're still in a world where fear trumps greed. You know, the pain taken during the GFC was deep. I mean, without government intervention, without policy intervention, without QE and things like that, it could have been an awful lot worse. But that was deeply traumatic on investing institutions and on the real estate sector and the banks that service it and so on. And that goes on for a long time. And I mean, if you look to, you know, Asia with the Asian tigers and the Asian debt crisis in the sort of, you know, late 90s, you know, they're still looking over their shoulders, petrified about the next Asian crisis. And that's 20 years ago. And they haven't had that crisis in the meantime. So the moment at which we tip over from being fearful into being greedy again, and you start getting that, I think I used the phrase earlier, irrational exuberance, which was a Greenspan comment from some years back, you know, when you start seeing that beginning to rise again, that seems to be, you know, something that concerns people. But the very fact they're concerned about it but they're not yet seeing it does seem to indicate it's not today's problem.
Just something to keep an eye on.
Oh yeah. This comes over, there's a risk that it comes over as sounding very, very positive. It's really not exuberant.
Mm.
People are not exuberant. If there's a risk around it, it's a bit around this capitulation on rates, that this is going to be long and low and there's going to be nothing that wobbles. Now, I find that hard to believe. The world wobbles. And if you think, we've not had a downturn since the big downturn of 7, 8 into 9. But if you think back to the Eurozone crisis of 10, 11, 12, which had kind of two legs into it, middle of 10 and then sort of middle of 11 and running out through 12, and things did slow, and you had GDP growth in the UK slowed as people looked at the Eurozone and went, oh goodness, this could be a problem, and it came out more slowly. We've got plenty of things, and you can point to all the causes of uncertainty that can cause that kind of wobble and concern. But if that's the nature of volatilities in cycles that we've got for the short to medium term, that isn't all gung-ho, full steam ahead, you know, we're all going to make a lot of money tomorrow. That is cautious optimism and recognising that, you know, it's low volatility around a low cycle, rather than shooting off, you know, boom and bust. You know, everything's up, everything's down in large volume. And you're seeing from that quite a lot of attraction to things like energy and infrastructure assets. There's a big demand for assets which have low correlation to economic cycles. So the demand risk is not GDP driven. And things that have inflation protection, because you do hear the word stagflation mentioned. You end up with potentially inflation pressures, but without the economic growth. Now, historically, that's tended to be because you have a lot of cost push inflation with a big currency move, and with whatever happens in the commodities cycle globally, you can create a stagflation type environment, particularly if you don't have a growing demographics. So if you've got kind of stalling demographics as the population ages, and if you've got a bit of commodity cost push and you've got low unemployment but not rising productivity, or stalling productivity, then you can see where you get that kind of stagflation where the demand pull isn't particularly great but the cost push is not very attractive. And you do see demand for asset classes that have that demand risk taken out, ideally, but often just not so GDP related, and have some degree of inflation protection in it. And again, you see this outside of pure infrastructure into why people are so attracted to things like PRS and student accommodation and things like that, which are not so directly related to GDP growth.
I suppose everyone needs a place to live regardless of what the economy is doing.
Exactly, and it's a bit, I mean, the logistics follows that as well. Okay, the big drive in logistics has been that, okay, and you've had people coming up with our sheds, the new shops and all this sort of thing. I think we've run a seminar on that basis at least once. And the answer is yes, but no. But a lot of it is that the changing pattern of behaviours, the way the economy works, means that you need what you've got, but you need more and different to service it in a different way. And there are sometimes negative implications into other sectors and assets that served a previous way of doing things. But the fact is that through the economy as a whole, doesn't matter whether the cycle's going up and down and so on, the vast majority of goods that move through warehouses continue to move through warehouses. You know, so it's quite a good sector, you know, and people are recognising that those cash flows that are generated from that keep on being generated. And when you've got your returns driven out of an income focus, that's really got some value, particularly if you look around the rest of the investment universe and find income in significantly short supply. We actually titled the event Keep Calm and Carry On, which I think we, you know, pinched from somewhere else. Actually, we changed it slightly. We said Keeping Calm and Carrying On, which actually did capture the mood, very much so.
Yeah, I heard someone else liken it to, you know, when you go to a theme park, you can either get on the roller coaster or the bumper cars, and right now we're on the bumper cars, not the roller coaster.
Yeah, but they feel pretty cushioned, you know. It's sort of the big shocks aren't happening. Now, you've got plenty of events out there that could be big shocks. You know, we've got some nailed-on expectations in all sorts of things, and, you know, people start worrying about geopolitics, but, you know, those risks are always with us, you know. You know, it's the Harold Macmillan events, dear boy, events, you know, and that the ability of the world to throw a spanner in the works is almost endless, but it doesn't happen very often. You know, these are, you know, high impact, low probability events, and so you want to make sure that, you know, you're not so exposed that if something goes wrong, you can't survive through it, but you don't base your core strategies on those.
So keep calm and carry on.
Keeping calm and carrying on.
Thank you, Graham.
Thank you.